First Annual Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, May 25th to 27th, 1984, held at the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Warm Springs, Georgia. Tape K201-3, Pathophysiology and Late Effects of the Motor Unit in Polio, presenter David O. Wickers. Changes in Spinal Cord Motor Neurons of Possible Relevance of the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis. Speaker B.E. Tomlinson.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to call this afternoon's meeting to order. The first speaker this afternoon is well known to us all. It's Dr. David Wickers, who is not only co-organizer of this very pleasant meeting, but is also a practicing physiatrist, a member of the faculty of Ohio State University, and beyond that, he's also a very fine electromyographer. And he's one of a small but select band of North American electromyographers who has been using the single fiber and related techniques to study neuromuscular diseases. And it is the results that Dr. Wickers has obtained with the single fiber scanning and macro EMG techniques that he will be telling us about this afternoon, together with the interpretation and the implication for an understanding of the pathophysiology of late polio muscles. Dr. Wickers.
Thank you, Dr. McComas. If I may have the lights off, please. We want to move on to a continued cellular level this afternoon. We saw the anatomy in our last lecture this morning, and now I would like to discuss with you some of the physiology. The basic pathophysiology of poliomyelitis was obviously a loss of anterior horn cells. When you lose an anterior horn cell for whatever reason, the motor neuron dies and the axon undergoes Wallerian degeneration, and we are left with free fibrillating muscle fibers, or muscles that have lost their trophic influence of nerve. Now, because some of the motor units survived polio and some of them were not affected, these normal functioning motor units that were in vicinity of free fibrillating muscle fibers were capable of sending out terminal axon sprouts and coming in contact with these free fibrillating muscle fibers. Now, when these sprouts came in contact with the fibers, a new neuromuscular junction or myoneural junction was produced. And then over a period of 4 to 6 months, this system matured, myelin was laid down on the sprout, the motor end plate matured and transmission became normal, and we ended up with motor units that contained more muscle fibers than they were originally designed to supply. So the pathophysiology in polio is a loss of anterior horn cells and then subsequently reinnervation by terminal axon sprouting. Now, how did the polio patient get strong again? Well, there were three factors involved. Number one, certain anterior horn cells, although as we learned this morning, resulted in being scarred, but did function again. Number two, there was reinnervation by terminal axon sprouting. And number three, exercise of these reinnervated motor units and of those normal motor units that survived the virus were strengthened. The muscles were strengthened, and that resulted in the slow but steady recovery, so that when the polio patient tells you that their recovery took several years, you can begin to understand the time frame before they reach their maximum recovery level. What I want to share with you this afternoon is a series of studies that we began in polio patients back in 1978 and 79. And we were using, at that time, the technique of single fiber electromyography to study transmission in reinnervated motor units. A brief word about single fiber electromyography for those of you who are not electromyographers in the audience. Single fiber electromyography is a means of using a 25 micron recording surface to actually record from an individual muscle fiber. And what we attempt to do is to move that recording surface between two muscle fibers that belong to the same anterior horn cell. And then what we are able to do is record the interval between when one muscle fiber of the motor unit receives the impulse and the time when the other muscle fiber, or the second fiber, receives the impulse. And this interval then is related to the variation in time and transmission down the axon, the time across the myoneural junction, and the time of transmission down the muscle fiber so that the electrode can pick up the depolarization. And if we do this in a normal individual, we can see the first fiber being held constant in time with some electronic devices, and we can see that there is a normal variation on these 10 superimposed discharges of this motor unit. There's normal variation in this transmission between fibers of a normal motor unit. Now, in diseases that affect the motor unit, especially the terminal axon or the myoneural junction or the muscle cell membrane, we can see some variation then in the ability of transmission to get to the various different muscle fibers of one motor unit. And you can see that there's a straight line through this recording such that at one firing of this motor unit, this second fiber did not receive the impulse to discharge. So here we have failure of transmission. Now I like to, this variation in transmission is referred to as jitter. And so I refer to the three determinants of jitter, or the three sites where jitter can be influenced. There's a certain amount of jitter, of course, that is normal, that relates to the normal variation in neuromuscular transmission at the end plate. So diseases that affect the terminal axon, disorders that affect the neuromuscular junction, and things that affect the muscle cell membrane can all have an influence on transmission within the motor unit. Now we can measure statistically this variability of transmission in a motor unit, and we use the term mean consecutive difference, or the MCD, to express the statistical variation. And we really don't need to talk about this at any length, but just to tell you that the normal variations in the muscle are in the neighborhood of 55 to 60 microseconds. Now, what do we find in this technique in reinnervation? Here we have a situation where we have reinnervation by terminal axon sprouting of fiber C, D, and E. We can see that fiber C is connected by one sprout, and fiber D and E are connected jointly by one sprout. Now, early in the course of reinnervation, these sprouts have difficulty getting the message to go out of the sprout itself from off of the main axon. So within the first couple months of reinnervation, there's a lot of failure of transmission at these branching sites, as demonstrated in the second discharge of this motor unit, where there's obviously a blocking of transmission out of this terminal sprout. We can also see variability in transmission, or jitter, as demonstrated by the dual arrow here, that is occurring because of an immature myoneural junction early on in the course of reinnervation. So these factors all go together in showing variability in transmission within the first 4 to 6 months and up to a year of reinnervation. One other technique that we can employ using this single fiber EMG is that of counting the number of muscle fibers that are within the recording area, which is approximately 300 microns, of this 25 micron recording surface. Normally, when you insert in muscle, you see one and sometimes two muscle fibers within this 300 micron hemisphere that belong to one anterior horn cell. Obviously, in a polio patient, when you inject this needle, what you see is many more fibers, five or six, that are within the recording area of this 25 micron recording surface, demonstrating reinnervation by terminal axon sprouting. So we have this term fiber density, which we can use to measure the mean of the number of muscle fibers belonging to a single motor unit that is within the recording area. And this is done statistically as outlined here on the slide. Normal fiber density is about 1.5. And fiber density increases very early in reinnervation and is actually the first indicator of reinnervation. Now, the study that I'm going to share with you is the first study that we did in polio patients back in 79. And the first study involved about 10 patients. We now have well over 20-some patients, all with essentially the same results. What we did was we took patients who were not complaining of weakness. We took patients who had no symptoms of progressive weakness, who had polio. And we examined the best muscle that they had. We wanted a grade G or better muscle. We did not want a weak muscle. So these are two very important facts. These were people who were old polios who were not complaining of increased weakness, and we used a very strong muscle, either G, G plus, G minus, and on one occasion normal. And we did routine EMGs in these individuals and found reinnervated motor units. So we knew that this muscle had been affected by the polio problem. We examined the anterior tibialis and the extensor digitorum communis because at the time in 1979, those essentially were the only muscles that we had normal data for. So I had to hand pick old polio patients on the basis of whether or not they had a grade G or better anterior tib or extensor hallucis longus, and also by the fact that they were not having symptoms of progressive weakness. So it actually became quite difficult to find this population back in those days. And we looked at their age versus their current age since polio, and you can see we had a wide spectrum coming all the way from people who were only 20 years post-polio or 22 post-polio all the way up to approximately 60 years post-polio. And we measured their fiber densities, and obviously they were all increased. Then we looked at their fiber density versus their current age, or the extent of reinnervation versus their current age, and there was no statistical correlation here. We then looked at their fiber density versus their years since polio, and there was no correlation there. Now we looked at the numbers of motor units that were recorded in these muscles that showed transmission abnormalities within the muscle. And we were very surprised to find that these people who had these large reinnervated motor units, that these reinnervated motor units were actually having transmission abnormalities within them. And the percentage of motor units that were abnormal was strikingly large. Now, we would anticipate that the motor unit would have stabilized after reinnervation within that first 6 months to 1 year after their recovery from polio. So here we were seeing motor units that were obviously very unstable and obviously abnormal. Now, if you'll notice, we had one patient who was 22 years post-polio who had no abnormalities in the muscle. The transmissions were normal. I wanted to be sure that that patient, we just didn't happen to get into a normal area of her muscle, so we repeated her study looking at various other areas of that same muscle, and we were able to find, after examining 42 motor units instead of the original 20 motor units sampled, that we could find a few abnormal fibers, but we really had to look very hard in this person who was only 22 years post-polio. Now, failures of transmission. The first study just demonstrated how many of them had abnormal variation in the ability to transmit within the motor unit. Now we're looking at how many of these individual muscle fibers didn't actually get the impulse when the motor unit discharged. In other words, one fiber of the motor unit got the message to depolarize, and another fiber of that same motor unit, with repetitive discharge of that motor unit, was missing the impulse. And we found a surprisingly large percentage of these reinnervated motor units, after firing repetitively, were actually not getting the impulse to depolarize. And then in plotting this and statistically determining where the line fell, we actually found a somewhat linear relationship between the percentage of motor units that had abnormal transmission versus their years since recovery from polio. So it appeared that the more years that it had been since you had had polio, the greater was the percentage of the motor units in these grade G or better muscles that were having difficulties with transmission. We then looked at the percentage of motor units that actually showed failure of transmission to some of their motor units, and we found the same linear type relationship between years since recovery from polio and the percentage of motor units in the polio patient that were actually failing to transmit to all of their muscle fibers. This also correlated with time since polio, or with years since polio. It also correlated with years and chronological age, or percentage of blocking and the actual age of the patient. I got two of the same slide by mistake. Now, we didn't talk about this specifically, but if you'll remember the slide of early reinnervation that I showed you, where we had two muscle fibers that were on the same sprout, and what you did with repetitive firing, you saw a loss of two fibers on one occasion. Whenever you would have groups of fibers that would fall out with repetitive discharge and then reappear, we referred to that as neurogenic blocking, because the blocking was obviously occurring at the branching site of that terminal axon. Neurogenic blocking was not seen in these reinnervated polio motor units. So what we saw were actually transmission abnormalities that we assume were not occurring at the junction site of that sprout. So the failure of transmission was most likely occurring at the myoneural junction, or possibly still the muscle membrane. So our conclusion was that there was a direct and positive correlation between the age since the recovery from polio and the percentage of reinnervated motor units that were showing difficulties in transmission, and that there was also a direct and positive correlation between the age since recovery from polio and the percentage of motor units that were actually failing to transmit to all of their muscle fibers. And then this current age was also direct and positively correlated. Now, that raises the question, is this weakness with advancing age in polio related to increased failures of neuromuscular transmission? We know that the patients who have myasthenia gravis, who have problems with neuromuscular transmission, present with complaints of fatigue. And we also know that these people also complain of weakness. Now, obviously, if the motor unit is not transmitting the impulse to all of its muscle fibers, then we're going to have a loss of muscle fibers with repetitive discharge of that whole muscle, and we're going to see some weakness in that muscle. So schematically, what we have is a normal motor unit, and this motor unit then is able to reinnervate muscle fibers that are orphaned by anterior horn cells that died from polio. After about 20 years or 25 years we start to see some mild abnormalities occurring in the transmission to some of these muscle fibers. And then with progressive age, we notice that these transmission abnormalities increase and the motor unit actually begins to have difficulty in transmitting to many of its muscle fibers. So the concept of peripheral disintegration of the motor unit needs to be addressed. We've already heard and read studies where you lose anterior horn cells with age. Is there some relationship between that and this peripheral disintegration? Does the reinnervated motor unit have a limited lifespan? And does this occur in other disorders besides polio? Well, we know that if you look at single fiber recordings in older individuals, over the age of 60, you can begin to see a few motor units showing transmission abnormalities. And with advancing age, the percentage of motor units show greater percentages of transmission abnormalities. An interesting fact in doing this study was frequently when we would have the patient with a motor unit that was obviously reinnervated, that was having transmission abnormalities, we would have them stop firing that motor unit for a while and rest, and then have them reactivate the motor unit. Surprisingly, the defect was repaired many times, or at least reverted back more towards normal with just brief seconds of rest. Resting for 5 or 10 seconds, then reactivating that motor unit again would allow that motor unit to fire at more normal transmission, and the degree of blocking would sometime reduce. On several recordings, while with one hand holding the 25 micron electrode perfectly still, not breathing, and with the other hand trying to inject 10 milligrams of Tensilon IV, I was able to get a few recordings with Tensilon injected that did not appear to alter the transmission. Although I haven't done enough, we did 4 or 5 of these people, we haven't done enough to be conclusive, but it did not appear that Tensilon would correct the abnormality.
Okay.
Yes?
Can we ask questions now?
You can ask a question now.
Wouldn't that indicate that it's the sprout then rather than the neuromuscular junction that's involved?
Well, I think number one, that this is inconclusive. The question is, because Tensilon in these few subjects that I was able to do the technique in did not repair the defect dramatically, is that a sign that the defect is not at the neuromuscular junction? And I would have to say I don't think that really rules it out. I think we got to do some additional studies. We can talk later. I have been doing some drug studies with Tensilon or with Mestinon in some patients, and we'll talk about that later. Walter Stoloff.
It wasn't clear from your slide that what was it that led you to the conclusion that it's not the terminal sprout that failed, but the myoneural junction?
The question has to do with what rules out the terminal sprout branching point from the main axon trunk as the site of failure. In a reinnervated motor unit, we know that more than one fiber is frequently on a terminal sprout that comes off the main axon. And therefore, if the abnormality was in the sprout, we would expect to see neurogenic blocking. Whenever you would be recording and you would see 4 or 5 muscle fibers all within the recording area, and then all of a sudden if 3 of those fibers fell out all at once as a group and then reappeared as a group and then fell out as a group, you would know that that blocking abnormality or that transmission abnormality was occurring at a branching site of a terminal twig where it comes off a main axon and is obviously supplying 3 muscles. We did not see this phenomenon of neurogenic blocking in these reinnervated polio motor units. So we concluded that the abnormality of transmission that we were detecting was probably not occurring at the at the terminal axon branching point off the main axon. The fact that Tensilon did not repair the defect may mean that it is an abnormality of acetylcholine release.
I suggest we go on to the last part of your presentation, David, if you may.
The next technique which we employed then was, with the next question that we had was, if these large reinnervated motor units are having transmission abnormalities, and if these transmission abnormalities are so severe that there is failure of transmission to some muscle fibers, are muscle fibers indeed dropping off of these reinnervated motor units? Are we seeing motor units that are, in a sense, giving up muscle fibers because they can no longer maintain or tend to them? And if so, that would certainly explain why we still see fibrillation potentials occurring in some older polio muscles. So we wanted a technique, we needed a way of looking at, is the motor unit getting smaller? So the technique of macro EMG was employed. This technique requires or employs recording from a very large surface, about 15 millimeters in size, so that one can record all of the discharges of the muscle cells that belong to one motor unit. Now, this is a technique that employs a lot of electronic gadgetry and some digital averaging, but basically what you do is you insert the electrode and find one single fiber, and you have in this electrode a single fiber electrode. Now, every time that muscle cell fires, every muscle cell that's connected to that motor unit is obviously going to get the message. So we can record from this cannula the entire motor unit. The question is, how do we pull it out of the background of all of the other muscle fibers that are in there? Well, if we have a mechanism whereby every time this muscle fiber gets the impulse, we take a sample of data from this great big large trocar that's sitting in the muscle, and we average repetitively 200 discharges or 300 discharges of that motor unit, we're eventually going to average out all of the background noise. And you can see the cannula recording here, and on the first channel you can see the single fiber that is underneath the recording surface. So with enough discharges, we're going to average out all of the randomly firing muscle cells or motor units and end up with those that are time-linked with this single fiber discharge. Now, in a reinnervated motor unit, this is what our motor unit looks like in comparison to a normal. So as you can imagine, that the shape and size of that macro potential is related mainly to the number of muscle fibers, and we know that in polio we have more muscle fibers per motor unit. These are some examples of recordings to show you what the shape looks like. The size is of large size. These are very large, of long duration and of a long, large area underneath the curve. Now, what we did now was to reverse our patient population. In the first study, we wanted people who were not having weakness, who were not having complaints, and we wanted to examine a very good muscle. In this study, I was more interested in those people who had a weak muscle. I wanted people who had a grade P or 2 over 5, or people who had a grade F or 3 over 5, and I wanted to look at their reinnervated motor units, because what I wanted to know is, what is the overall size of these reinnervated motor units, and will I find motor units that are smaller than normal? And what I found was that in looking at the polios, that the percentage of abnormal recordings was quite high in people who were only a few years post-recovery. And that as I got older, the percentage of normal motor units became larger. No macro potential was found to be smaller than normal. So we did not find any motor units that were smaller than normal size. There did appear to be, as the older population were looked at, or the people longest since recovery from polio, we don't have enough data, but there appears to be this trend that the percentage of normal motor units seems to be increasing as you get older. So if indeed peripheral disintegration of the motor unit is occurring, then one would theorize that what we're doing is we're throwing off those muscle fibers that had been reinnervated until we get back to normal size, and that we're not falling below normal size. So if we look at this teleologically, we have a basic mechanism that is designed to drive so many muscle fibers. The energy supply is the motor neuron. The motor neuron is then given additional muscle fibers which it must drive and must supply. And after 25 to 30 years, it starts to have difficulty supplying all of the muscle fibers. And so possibly what we're seeing is a dropping off of some of the reinnervated fibers from the motor unit, and it is reverting back to its normal size to a level that metabolically it can handle. Now, if this abnormality is occurring in all polio patients, or at least it was occurring in these patients that we examined who weren't having complaints, why do some people have symptoms and why do some people not have symptoms? If the same pathophysiology is occurring in all polio people, some people are complaining of problems and others are not. So what is the difference? Well, if you have a benign form of polio and you don't lose that many anterior horn cells, then losing a few muscle fibers from a muscle may not make a great deal of difference. On the other hand, if you have severe and more localized polio, let's say that both legs are totally non-functional and you've used crutches and long leg braces all your life and your upper extremities are normal, or essentially normal, then you're not going to notice a change either. And this is a concluding slide just to demonstrate that studies of macro EMG in ALS show a very similar resemblance to the same phenomenon that is occurring in polio. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, David Weekers, for presenting these very interesting results. And there's little doubt in the minds of those of us who practice EMG that these new techniques will give us very precise information about motor unit architecture in conditions such as post-polio. Now, if I could just make three very quick points. It's obvious, I suppose, from your single fiber work with the blockings, that the instantaneous muscle strength may well be reduced in your polio patient, but I'd have thought it was also true that fatigue would be even more a major factor for these patients, inasmuch that as you go on making your contraction and using frequencies, real frequencies, higher than those that you're using for your single fiber studies, the incidence of dropouts is going to increase. I'd like you to comment on that, and also another point related to Dr. Stoloff's question about how do you distinguish between blocking due to neuromuscular junction abnormality and axonal abnormalities. Because it seems to me that if you just have a single fiber dropping out, that it would be possible that there may be another fiber connected to the same sprout which is also dropping out, but which is outside the range of your pickup area.
Those are excellent questions. I'll answer the last one first. I think that the answer to the question as to where is the transmission failure occurring is I don't know. And I think that there are three possible sites: the terminal axon, the neuromuscular junction, or the muscle cell membrane. And I guess my personal gut feeling is that It's either the terminal axon or it's the presynaptic portion of the neuromuscular junction. But I think further studies obviously need to be done, and we certainly don't have the answer yet. The second question, which was originally the first question, dealing with repetitive discharge of these motor units, one of the abnormalities or one of the observations of abnormalities was where we would get a motor unit, and it takes a while to learn this technique, and it takes a while to get a good recording, and it takes a long time to develop the capabilities of holding a 25 micron electrode in contact with a 60 micron fiber and not moving for a period of 5 or 10 minutes while you watch some of these motor units fire on at long intervals. And when you did that, and when you were successful at that, you were rewarded, because usually the transmission defect was really brought out the longer you could continue to watch the abnormality. Frequently, a patient would start contracting the muscle and there would be very little variation in transmission. And then as time went on, the transmission abnormality would increase, and then finally, all of a sudden, some of the fibers would start blocking. And then pretty soon, if you did it for extended periods of time, the muscle fiber that you were triggering the potential from would block, and the screen would go blank. And we'd let the patient rest for a while, and then you'd ask him to try and bring it back, and lo and behold, it would come back and start to fire again. And then you could fatigue it out, and the screen would go blank. So there's no question that the longer these motor units fired and the faster that we could get them to fire, the greater were the abnormalities displayed.
Dave, did you ever splint a patient over a week or two and see whether or not that decreased their jitter or their block?
The question has to do with some type of treatment and following it with single fiber recordings. And I think that you have reached the limitation of the technique. I am able to record from 2 muscle fibers or 3 muscle fibers within a large muscle. My ability to do any form of treatment that is not instantaneous and look at the results is impossible, because I can't find that same muscle fiber again.
How about with macro EMG? Do you think that would be a way of evaluating a treatment modality?
There were several points in macro that I didn't bring out, and I will take this opportunity. Number one was that macro EMG records from the whole motor unit. And because the recording surface is so large, you don't have to be close to the motor unit to get the response. In other words, you can be in the periphery of the motor unit and still get the same size and shape potential, or essentially the same. And the technique involves going through the muscle and trying to find 20 different motor units. Many times in patients who had a grade P or MRC scale 2 over 5, it became difficult to find 20 different motor units within the whole muscle. So I really have a feeling that there's a lot less motor units in there doing the job than we really thought. And I'm sure that if we took some people who had a limited number of motor units and very specifically tattooed their skin and marked recording sites, that we could probably follow the number of motor units present over a period of time. My concern with that would be I'm not sure how much damage I'm doing to those motor units by inserting an electrode into the middle of it. So I think the study could be done, but I would have to see what effect it would have and evaluate the results in light of the fact that you are damaging a certain percentage of muscle fibers every time you insert the needle.
One last question over there.
Parsons from Denver. Dave, the last phenomenon that you described there in terms of increasing the fatigue of a given muscle during sampling, assuming your steady hand and no extra coffee that morning and so forth, that eventually the whole motor unit blocked. Is that what you said?
This is correct only in a few motor units. This was not a universal occurring phenomenon. This was in a few motor units that were having very serious transmission abnormalities on routine testing that when we really tried to stress them over long periods of time, you could get two of the fibers. Remember, I'm only looking at two or three fibers of a whole motor unit, okay? And they may have all been on the same twig for all I know, okay? But you could get two to block at the same time.
So it doesn't. What you're saying then does not necessarily imply that the whole axon or the whole motor unit itself just shorts out.
That is correct. I think what we were recording was not only one fiber shutting down, but many fibers of the same motor unit also being able to shut down.
I really think we ought to stop now because we were a quarter of an hour late starting the session. And having brought our next speaker all the way from Britain, we certainly cannot infringe on his time. And what I would like to suggest is that we run 10 minutes into the tea break, or coffee break, as I should say here. I'm sure many of you have more questions for Dr. Wickers, and I suggest that you catch him during the next break. Now, the next speaker is Dr. Bernard Tomlinson, a professor of neuropathology at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne, England. And Dr. Tomlinson, one may call a quantitative neuropathologist. He is a neuropathologist who not only describes things, but also measures them, counts them. And over the years, he has built up a considerable reputation, partly on the basis of his work on Alzheimer's disease, but also on his studies, which are almost unique, on the numbers of neurons, numbers of motor neurons in the human spinal cord. And it is about this last work that he will now address us.
Thank you, Alan, very much. One possible explanation for delayed deterioration in muscle strength and function in survivors of poliomyelitis could obviously be, and it's been postulated several times today, further loss or dysfunction of those cells which survive the initial attack. I think it's true to say that this, at this moment we have no morphological evidence that this is so. In this paper, I'm going to look at the evidence that loss of motor neurons with increasing age may contribute to late deterioration in poliomyelitis, and also that immobilization of prolonged and severe kind might be responsible for further loss. I shall also look at one example of motor neuron damage, that is axotomy, produced by limb amputation in humans, which it is now known results in delayed loss of motor neurons, and that's a situation which may have some parallel with that of late deterioration in poliomyelitis. Now, studies on the total numbers of motor neurons in the human lumbar, in the human spinal cord have been very few, and until the early 70s, they were only estimates based on quite inadequate attempts at quantitation. In 1973, with two colleagues in Newcastle, Dorothy Irving and Jan Rebays, we started a study on the aging human spinal cord, which lasted for a number of years. In the first place, we counted in serial sections all motor neurons with a nucleolus visible within the cell. This, of course, was to avoid multiple counts of the nerve cells themselves in serial sections, since they're much larger than the thickness of the sections we were using. From these observations, thank you, we found a method which was accurate to within 3% of those found by counting serial sections, but in which we only counted every fifth section out of the whole series from each lumbar sacral cord. We then compared the right and left sides in a series of individuals. We compared the variations in different segments and the variations that could occur in single sections. And in 1977, we published an account of the numbers of motor neurons in the lumbosacral spinal cord in 47 subjects between 13 and 95 years of age.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over now to continue listening on side two.